And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Katie Simpson-Smith back to the program today. Katie received rave reviews for her debut novel set in coastal Carolina during the Revolutionary War, The Story of Land and Sea, when it was published in 2014. 2016 sees the publication of her second novel, Free Men, which is set in the 1780s in what would become the state of Alabama. Katie, there's an epigraph at the beginning of Free Men from a historical text. Where did you first come across Albert James Pickett and his writing?
I was actually working on a contemporary short story set in South Alabama as an experiment for my MFA program, and was doing deep research into the region to get a better sense of the area and the geography and the history. And I found this book as a great example of early Alabama history, which didn't become a state until the 19th century, of course, but it recounted the story of these three very different men from 1788, a white man, a black man, and an Indian who joined forces to commit an atrocious murder and then stayed together afterwards. And I thought, what an amazing example of how intertwined the South is. How intertwined it was and how it continues to be, such that there are no natural divides between races and classes, that we're all sort of in this project together.
Now, the language Pickett uses is kind of hyperbolic.
Yeah.
Did you find any other historical sources to back up?
This is the only mention of this episode in any historical record that I could find. And yet it gave Murder Creek, the waterway just south of Evergreen, Alabama, its name. So if you talk to residents there, you know, they know the history and they can attest to the story. But one doesn't actually know, you know, to what extent Albert James Pickett was telling the truth, or whether this is just another Southern tall tale.
Was this part of Alabama part of West Florida or part of the Georgia claim?
It was part of what was called the Yazoo Lands of West Georgia, but was an incredibly contested plot of land between West Florida, the French to the west, the British, and then the Americans to the east, and then a very powerful Creek nation to the north. So a lot of people were trying to get their claws into this particular geography.
And at that time, around this area, the Spanish kind of had the most control.
Yeah, they were sending traders across paths in the south and were looking very dominant. But so were the Creeks in terms of just sheer manpower and fighting force. So there's no sense that this region would ever become part of the United States.
So when you have all this political machination going on, how do you go about finding the personal, the emotional in that?
Right. I decided to make these three men, the three protagonists, of whom we know very little historically. I wanted to make them kind of representatives of the dispossessed, to have them have their stake in the political world at that time be fairly low. So Bob, who is the African-American character, is an escaped slave from a sugar plantation, and all he wants is to get out west and find land of his own and get as far away from other humans as possible, because he has not been particularly well treated by his fellow humans. And then the white man, Cat, I really wanted to show that whiteness was not a guarantee of privilege in this time period. So he's very poor. He comes from a rural background, is orphaned, desperately lonely. And then finally, Estelicha, who's the Indian character, comes from a Creek tribe that has aspirations to power, but Estelicha himself is cut out of power because he witnesses a murder that his chief enacts on another man in his tribe. So all of the men are cut out of those conversations that we think of happening in the late 18th century about national identity and who's going to control this place. And these are men who just want to control their own lives, which is difficult enough.
The book itself opens on March 9th, 1788, with a Frenchman who goes by many names, but in this case, he's going by Louis Leclerc Mofort, and he's been given some orders by a Muscogee Creek chief by name of Seloatka.
Yes, so Leclerc is a wonderful character to write because he's the sort of prototypical outsider. He comes from France. He doesn't really understand what America is all about, but he's fascinated by it. So when he starts tracking these men, he's assigned to hunt them down and bring them to justice, whether that means killing them or scalping them. He's fascinated by the fact that the three men would stay together and what backgrounds they came from, such that they would find some common thread between them. So he's sort of a self-styled anthropologist.
Even maybe a proto-psychologist.
Yeah. It's kind of nice to have that stand-in for the reader who is as distant from the 18th century as Leclerc was from America. So we have a voice for us watching these men and trying to figure out these men.
It's nice because you can have that psychology explicitly discussed with it being part of the plot and not just being kind of this thing you shoehorn in.
Right, exactly.
Leclerc was a real man. He had a memoir. Did this period come up in his memoir?
His memoir was actually written as a kind of political statement for Napoleon. When he went back to France after these years living with the Creek Indians, he tried to convince Napoleon to hold on to the Louisiana Purchase, the Louisiana territories, with the help of the Creeks. He said, if we use these strong allies, we can hold on to the territories and eventually take over the entire country. And within a few years, Napoleon sold it to America and paid no attention to Leclerc. But he wrote this memoir to show how close he was to the Creeks as a way to convince the political sort of elite in France. So he talks a lot about Creek culture and Creek lifeways. He doesn't talk explicitly about this episode, but he does talk about being a sort of tracker for hire. And I chose not to read his memoir until after I'd written a first draft of his voice, because I just didn't want his actual words to infect me in any way. I wanted to sort of imagine my own way into him. And then when I actually picked up the memoir, I was dumbfounded because his voice was almost exactly the same voice that I had invented.
Right.
I think it just goes to show that there are only so many ways to be a Frenchman in the 18th century. Like, he's kind of narcissistic and uses relatively pompous and pseudoscientific language. And so I thought, okay, I've hit on the right track with him.
He's kind of a transition figure between Humboldt and de Tocqueville, I imagined him.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
We also learn that Leclerc's father abandoned his family. And much like in your first book, The Story of Land and Sea, the loss or absence of parents is a big part of all the characters' lives in this book as well.
Yeah, I think for me, family for characters can be a little bit of a crutch. And when you take away such important family members like mothers and fathers, you're really setting the character out on their own and saying, you have to figure out how to live on your own terms. I think that's a rich place for fiction. And so all of these characters are grappling with these big holes in their backgrounds that then color the choices that they make in the present day of the narrative.
So how do you choose whether it's the mother or father you take away from a particular character?
It's kind of like a Disney movie, you know, when the mother always dies at the beginning.
Well, I heard that's very important for young adult and children's fiction in order to give them enough agency of their own that they have to be able to make their own decisions. And if a parent or authority figure is around, they can't do that.
Right. Sort of launching into independence, which is the theme of the book, too. I just sort of pick whatever I think will work for that character.
About a third of the book is dedicated to going back in the lives of our main trio of Bob, Cad, and Estelicha. Each of these things are told in a big siloed section. Why did you choose this approach instead of kind of breaking it up and doing a more interwoven approach toward the narrative?
I really wanted to give the backstories their own due. I was concerned that if I tried to weave that in a more organic way into the present day narrative, it would be distracting enough that readers would just want to get to what happens next in the present day, that they would skip over these sections. But by sort of cordoning them off and making you dive very deep into these men's backgrounds for 50 pages, you're forced to grapple with their lives as they were and not necessarily as they're affecting the present day. And I think having that deep interaction with the characters' pasts then allows the reader to have a stronger connection with the characters in the present.
And the first of the characters we get to see their past is Bob, the enslaved man on a sugarcane farm. And we learn that it was his grandmother who was captured in Africa and brought to America.
Yeah. So his mother has this great tradition of telling her children stories about Africa as they're growing up. And we're not totally certain how much of these stories she's making up. But one of the things I found in my research over and over again was this importance placed on family history among enslaved communities, because there were so many family ties that were broken in any way that they could hold on to a sense of a continued past was so important for their current identity. I loved being able to have this mother figure come in and tell stories about not only their own ancestors, but sort of earlier stories like African myths about antelopes and panthers and whatnot.
Bob has an older brother whose name is Primus, and Primus is a thinker, has a lot of wisdom, and that really influences Bob a lot.
Yeah, Primus is also a doer. Like, he has big dreams, and he's working to make them happen. And Bob is, as a younger sibling, pretty content with his life. He doesn't have the same dreams that Primus has. And when he has to strike out on his own, I think he's forced to come to terms with the fact that if you want to survive in a life in slavery, and even in a life in America, you have to have those dreams. You have to be striving for something other than your particular lot in life. So that's what Primus and the memory of Primus teaches him.
In this contested area they live, I think during the Revolutionary War, the Spanish government had promised freedom to Africans and formerly enslaved people if they came to the North Florida area. It seems kind of everything's kind of up for grabs in this place.
Yeah. The plantation that he is enslaved on is run by a couple. There's a British man and his Spanish wife. And so when the British have control of West Florida, the man is in charge and is running everything. And then when the Spanish take over and the rest of the British are fleeing the province, instead, the Spanish wife decides to take over the plantation, and they just switch roles so that they can keep their land.
It's a pretty handy arrangement.
Yes. And she's a very smart lady herself, too. But you're absolutely right that there's so much sort of up for grabs.
We can see how she can be an unsympathetic character in a lot of ways because she's very kind of mercurial and kind of petty in her wielding of power. But we learned that, you know, she was married off to this man. And much as Bob is married off to his wife, Minna, without either their permissions, essentially, that women didn't have a whole lot of control of their lives at the time. And so many marriages were arranged.
Right. And there's this weird sort of parallel between the Spanish mistress's life and Winna's life, as you note. And yet that didn't mean that they had any kind of bond between them, sort of natural sympathy for each other, as we see. At times, the Spanish mistress tries to tell Winna to, you know, stick up for herself and to seek freedom. And then an hour later, she's whipping her in the yard for some act of insurrection. And so I wanted to show sort of ideal of the slave mistress as being someone who both has things in common with the plight of women, no matter their race or class, but also was invested in the use of power and cruelty.
Also, like in the story of Land and Sea, you investigate that love can be a liability for people who are enslaved.
Yeah, trying to write about families in slavery is so hard because you want to recognize that real love did and could exist, that the system of enslavement did not completely dehumanize those who were in it. And yet you have to recognize that the mothers and fathers understood that any attachment they had to their children was necessarily transitory. So how do you regulate your love based on the fact that it could be taken away at any point? So writing about those kinds of relationships was hard to sort of get that balance right.
Bob works himself up into a position of trust in the British slave owner's eyes, and he's entrusted to trade rum with the local native populations.
Yeah, so this is a little measure of freedom. Bob is allowed a horse and can move on his own up to the Creek Nation and trade rum and bring back messages. And it's sort of indicative of Bob's character that he doesn't use this opportunity immediately to escape, that the master sees something in him that is trustworthy. And it's that sort of lack of big dream. But gradually over time, we see Bob understanding, like, wait a second, like, I could use this to my benefit. And so it's interesting to see then how he uses those connections to sort of make an escape.
As we know about the Battle of New Orleans, news gets to the frontier kind of late sometimes.
Yeah.
And we have one person in this story delivering newspapers, but it's for horoscopes. So what was behind the choice of having a traveling horoscope author in there?
He was more sort of a gift of the imagination. There are a couple of characters here that are a little bit more mystical than practical. But there's so much about this time in American history where you just have people doing weird things, you know, like nothing was nailed down in terms of appropriate behavior or in terms of, you know, scientific accuracy. And so the idea of a man just out there trying to convince people that he could read their futures was compelling for me.
In the contemporary action, Bob has absconded and he comes upon Cat, who's one of the strangest white men he's ever encountered.
Yeah. Yeah, Cat is very small and very sad and does not seem to recognize that his whiteness puts him a notch above Bob. Bob keeps expecting him to act like a master or to take advantage of him or turn him in. But Cat doesn't do any of these things, partially because he's dealing with his own emotional traumas. But it's a real test for Bob to see how much he can trust someone else, given that his whole life has dictated that people who look like that cannot be trusted.
Especially since they run across a man who's searching for a killer, and Bob thinks that Cat might very well be this killer in hiding.
Yeah. And so there's an element of danger from Bob's perspective. And yet he has to rationalize that, okay, I too am a fugitive from justice. And maybe he had as much reason to do whatever murdering he did in South Carolina as I had for escape.
Well, I would say he's a fugitive from the law, maybe not necessarily
yes.
justice.
Yes.
Kat's father wasn't that paternal, and his mother was never in the picture. I guess she died in childbirth or had run away. Did it say in the book? I'm sorry.
There's some mystery around it, but at one point his dad, in a drunken state, talks about having knocked his wife's head.
Mm.
So I think there's a possibility that his dad killed his mom.
And it seems he's very much in the Pap Finn mold of characters. But Kat is very far away from being like Huck Finn. He has been cowed by this man.
Right. And that, too, was a hard character to write because he goes through a lot of emotional and physical abuse and still has this little thing in him that's searching for love and yet doesn't have the spunk of Huck Finn or the ingenuity to really pursue that. So his life kind of shuttles him from place to place almost against his will, and he has to figure out a way to make that particular place work for him.
And he makes his way to an orphanage and suffers tragedy there and then is taken on by a doctor of sorts. It's a very difficult relationship in all directions, but especially with the son of the doctor.
Yeah. So the doctor is a surgeon who invites Kat into his surgery to be an apprentice. So Kat sees all manner of gory 18th century medical solutions. And the son of the doctor kind of has a similar relationship that Kat had with his own father in terms of frequent abuse. But this boy has a little bit more life to him than Kat did. And so he tries to befriend him, and that doesn't really work out.
And as this maturation is supposed to be happening in Kat, it's also the time of the Revolutionary War. So there's chaos in society as well as the personal chaos in this doctor's home.
Right. And you think, how can you make a solid, stable life for yourself when everything around you is constantly in upheaval, again, both personally and politically?
As we go on back in the contemporary action of the story, we learn how the massacre that they're accused of happens. And we see that guilt is really starting to chew on these men's souls.
The murder sort of happens by accident because what they're really after is the sacks of silver. And they think money is the solution to their three individual problems. And yet they, you know, inadvertently wake the sleeping men and they end up having to defend their own lives. So yes, they have taken the lives of other men, but they still feel like it was possibly justified based on all the abuses that have been leveled at them by the societies that they came from. And so it's hard to get into characters who I wanted to be sympathetic to the readers. So how do you have protagonists who are murderers and also someone that readers can sympathize with? They won't discount out of hand. So I think guilt is the key to that.
And we see that these men commit no crimes that had not already been committed against them
exactly.
or people they loved.
Exactly.
And so we just see that so much of the misery in our world is because of cyclical things
yes.
like this.
Yep. As several of the characters noted, it's a big wheel turning around and around again.
Now, lastly, we learn about Istolicha's past. He has an uncle is it the Miko?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is essentially the chief of their band of Muscogee Creek Indians.
Yeah, and he has so much admiration, sort of boyish love for this uncle figure. But when he's very young, he goes out on his first fighting trip to battle against the Choctaws and witnesses his uncle's murder by another member of the tribe who is trying to seek power for himself. Because Istolicha is so young at this point, he doesn't know how to respond to this. He knows that he's supposed to seek vengeance for his family and his clan, but he's just a boy, you know, and trying to figure out how to avenge his uncle's death is not an easy thing. But this continues to haunt him and sort of burrow into his soul for the next 10 or 15 years as he devises a plan that he thinks will bring him power again.
He has seen that avenging deaths and wrongs against the Choctaws and others has led to his older brother's deaths as well.
Right.
So he doesn't see that as the right way to go about things.
Right. He wants to do everything nonviolently, which is very much a modern kind of approach in Creek politics. He is witness to the influence of money in the Southeast and how all of the other colonial powers are using it for power, political power and social power. And he sees that the future of the Creek Nation is going to be an adaptation. So he thinks that by forging alliances and by making economic connections with other towns and nations, he can create a sort of bloodless revolution in his own community.
But he just might be a little bit ahead of his time on that.
Yeah.
Well, Well, and it is very forward-thinking to view that units of exchange
right.
could hold a power into themselves.
Right.
It's a strange parallel between Leclerc and Estalicia that they're both forward-thinking and experts in the natural world as well, and they also share the pain of being betrayed by their women.
The relationship, especially that Estalicia has with his true love, Polly, is so complex because they both want things very desperately, and that it's not necessarily always each other that they want. She, too, is seeking power and is seeking change and a more modern way of life. And in his mind, she just should be basically a good girlfriend who, like, sits around and waits for him to come home with money and tales from the road. But she becomes a very strong-willed character in her own right. I think a lot of these men in the book sort of take their women for granted or don't fully understand the power that they're capable of. And yet you see the women time and again sort of being able to take action where the men were just flailing around.
Well, I mean, if we still do that today, what chance did they have back then?
Yeah.
Now, probably the most centered and calm person in the book is Istolich's brother, Oche.
Yeah. Oche exists between worlds. He's one of what the Creeks call the two-spirit people. So he doesn't have sort of masculine traits or masculine interests of fighting. He's much more interested in working in the fields with the women. And so he exists sort of off the gender spectrum. And as a result, he can interact with both worlds and have sympathy for both worlds and has a very sort of broad understanding of how time works and how memory works. And he keeps trying to impart this wisdom to Estalicia, who is very much a boy and is not willing to listen to anything rational.
But he does have a fear of guilt in its way because of the ghost children. He's
yeah.
afraid of these spirits who seek vengeance in the spirit realm.
Right. So whenever he's on the trail, he has to cover himself because he's afraid the ghost children are going to come try to steal his soul.
And also to think about a character in the 18th century who is OCD as he is, who lives out in nature, is just a fabulous idea.
Yeah, thank you. He always is trying to like clean up the leaves around him.
You can see that as valuable in trying to throw someone off your trail, but even in the village, he's lining up things in the house. And
yeah, I really wanted to give him a trait that would be sort of counter to everything we understand about what someone would be like if they lived in that kind of community, and just a reflection of the fact that we all deal with these very personal issues.
Now, when you were researching the Muscogee Creek people of the time, was there anything in their society that America in general would have been a lot better had they adopted?
Yeah, I mean, I think their political process was a lot saner than American politics at least have become in terms of inviting participation from the entire community. So at council meetings, the elders were the sort of main decision makers, but then in the benches around the fire were also the women of the community and the children. And if at any point, you know, someone didn't agree with the course that the elders were taking, they could speak up. And I think in American politics for many years, anyone other than elite white men were forbidden from that kind of political discussion. So I think there's an egalitarianism among Creek society politically and also socially that Americans would have done well to adopt.
Do you know how big their villages and their towns were? I mean, would it be like about 150 people? I know that's kind of like the maximum number of people you could know personally.
Yeah, it would be bigger than that. So several hundred. The towns were divided up into two main groups, the Upper Creek towns and the Lower Creek towns. And there was a certain degree of political alliance among those towns, but the individual towns also had authority to conduct affairs on their own. So you see that Estalicia's town just makes a decision to go out battling the Choctaws, whereas a nearby town may have made the decision to stay at home and not engage in warfare. So there's a good bit of autonomy.
Now, you mentioned earlier you had found Pickett because of researching a contemporary short story, and both your novels so far have been historical, and you have a PhD in history. Do you have any aims to write a novel that's set in contemporary or recent history?
I do kind of feel like I've milked the late 18th century for what it's worth. I would like to write about a different period, and I'm not sure when that will be. I don't shy away from contemporary society. I'm most interested in writing about stuff I don't know about yet, and so that's tended to be historical because there's so much to explore about the past. But if I could find a character or a situation that was totally foreign to me in the 21st century, I think I would be equally engaged with that.
Now, of course, you received a lot of praise for The Story of Land and Sea, and the early reviews of Freeman have been glowing. Do reviews mean anything to you?
I think the healthiest view is that reviews don't really mean anything positive or negative, that it's just all about the work and getting the work done. And the writing itself is both the most enjoyable part of the process and also the most excruciating part of the process. But that's where sort of all the emotions come out and hit the page. That being said, it's still really lovely to read a nice review. So I'm very appreciative. And it's just, it's meaningful to know that the book is connecting with readers. I think I'll always value that.
And also, you've written very strongly from male points of view in your books. You had a little bit more of a female presence in The Story of Land and Sea. Do you think you might get around to writing the main character being a woman?
Yeah, again, I think the impulse to write men is to write about people I don't know. But clearly there's a lot I don't know about my fellow women. So hopefully I'll have a good, strong female character soon.
So have you started working on another book?
I have, but it's in like the terrible early stages where everything you write just sounds awful. But the current project, and I don't know whether it'll ever see the light of day, but it's set in Rome. So a big leap across the ocean.
Well, Katie, I want to thank you so much for stopping back by on Book Talk and sharing Free Men with us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Katie Simpson-Smith is the author of Free Men, which is published by Harper. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcast of Book Talk, as well as download podcast at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.